Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm the other host, Aaron Matte.
How you doing, Aaron?
I'm good, Katie. How was your week?
It was good. Thanks for asking. I actually, on Monday, went to a very fun block party celebrating the freedom of Stephen Donziger, friend of show. He's been on both this show with Matt Taibbi, so before your time, and he's been on the Katie Halper show. And he is, for people who don't know, he's an environmental and human rights lawyer who was persecuted and prosecuted by Chevron. Seriously, he was locked up. He was under house arrest, and then he was sent to prison, federal prison. And then he was allowed to serve the rest of his sentence out under house arrest again. And when he was under house arrest, he had like an ankle monitor and everything. And he had to check in with the halfway house. And his crime was successfully suing Chevron for poisoning the people of Ecuador. That's really what, I mean, obviously it was a technicality that they got him on. Not that. It was actually not turning over his laptop and cell phone, which is so obviously something that a lawyer should have the right not to do. And because he appealed that that order, he was in contempt, criminal contempt. It's an unprecedented case in many ways because it really was an overt corporate prosecution, because the Southern District of New York declined to prosecute this case because it was so ridiculous. So this judge, Judge Lewis Kaplan, a Clinton appointee, handed the case over to a corporate law firm, which had represented Chevron. They took over, prosecuted Donziger, and Louis Kaplan also, that same judge, handpicked the judge to oversee the contempt trial, the contempt case. And that judge is Loretta Preska, who is a member of the Federalist Society, major right-wing legal society, which also gets money from Chevron. And it was so corrupt. When she sentenced him to the maximum six-month sentence, she said that only the proverbial two-by-four between the eyes would instill in Mr. Donziger respect for the law. He lost his law license. He's been disbarred. The people of Ecuador, on whose behalf he sued Chevron, he won them. He and other lawyers, including Ecuadorian lawyers, won a $9.5 billion settlement. And they haven't paid a cent because they've basically used Stephen's case to try to block payment. And the people there are still... They got cancer, they had birth defects increased, and they're still being poisoned now. They still haven't cleaned it up. It's like an insane, insane story. So the good news is he's free. The bad news is that they still haven't paid the people of Ecuador what they owe them. It was a fun block party. Will Menaker was there from Chapa Trap House. Christian Smalls was there, which was really exciting. The, you know, the Amazon labor leader. Susan Sarandon was there. Donziger's lawyers were there. Ron Kuby and Marty Garbus. Marty Garbus represented Nelson Mandela, Cesar Chavez, Lenny Bruce. It was great. It was really fun. I'm so happy for Stephen. And but we got to keep fighting.
Well, listen, the story of Stephen Donziger is unbelievable. And you've done a great job covering it at the Katie Halper Show. And I cannot believe that, like, the idea that a judge can say, you know what? Yeah, the courts did want to take this, but let's keep it rocking. Let's farm it out to a private firm that is tied to the company that Steve Donziger defeated. Right, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. By the way, Aaron, it looks like you have horns on your head.
Really?
Your head. Yeah, because the plants.
When art reveals the truth about life.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
That's
people
better.
Really did like your call center. Headphones.
Oh, they love that. I know. I got
so
a lot
maybe
of.
Maybe you can get one with devil's ears.
That's a great idea. Yeah. For people who missed it, I wore a headset in last week's episode. I got a lot of bullying. I've never been internet bullied as much as I have since I joined this show, Katie. So
yeah.
Thanks for that.
That's because the people love you. They know you're strong.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They do.
And your week, was it good?
My week was interesting. I had this one thing happen where Facebook suspended people for sharing an article that I recently wrote. It's about Syria. It was published in Real Clear Investigations. And the article just points out the fact that the current team of top officials in the Biden White House, under Obama, they presided over a policy of arming an insurgency that was dominated by Al-Qaeda and basically lying to the public and claiming that they were arming moderate rebels when they knew all along that the insurgency was dominated by Al-Qaeda and its allies. And I sort of go through the history of that and how it helped create, among other things, what Brett McGurk, who is now a senior official under Biden, calls al-Qaeda's largest safe haven since 9/11. And that's the province of Idlib, which the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria now controls. And that was captured by al-Qaeda and its allies with U.S. support. So I'm putting out just what a major scandal this is and how there are parallels to what Biden is doing right now in Ukraine, flooding it with weapons, having no idea where these weapons will end up, overlooking concerns about these weapons getting in the hands of extremists. In Syria, it was al-Qaeda and even ISIS getting U.S. weapons. And in Ukraine, the Azov Battalion and other far-right extremists and Nazis will be getting U.S. are getting U.S. weapons too. And of course, doing this in a proxy war in which the U.S. and Russia are on opposite sides of the same battlefield, which is very dangerous. Anyway, so I wrote this article, and when people have been trying to share the Substack version at matthew.substack.com, they've been getting suspended from Facebook, and it's happened to a bunch of people, and I have no idea what to do about it except just complain publicly, but it's crazy.
So they can send it, they can, so you publish this on your Substack and also through Real Clear Politics.
At Real Clear, yeah. And the Real Clear link, the Real Clear link, people are not getting suspended for, but the Substack link, they are.
What if Real Clear is behind it and this is an attempt to make sure people give them the traffic and not your Substack?
That would be a, hey, then I would say respect.
Then respect you
for
say
taking
respect,
out of the competition. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
That's taking it to a new level.
But that's really awful.
It's too bad.
Suspended? You know, for, how long are the suspensions lasting?
Some people, a few people said 30 days. A few people said it was shorter. So let me just apologize to anyone who got suspended from Facebook for my sake. I'm sorry for that. And, you know, I will write Facebook to complain. But aside from that, I just, you know, these are our masters. These are our tech overlords. Not
Maybe
so much
you can
we
write
can
a
do.
Piece for Real Clear. In fact, if they're not down, if they say no, you know what that's going to suggest.
That means they're that means it was down.
They're in, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we can follow it up and we'll expose whoever is behind this. We'll expose them.
I was going to say you should thank people and like write a public post thanking people with their names, but that's actually not good because then they'll probably be targeted.
Yeah. Who knows what other suspensions await them?
That's awful.
Yeah.
That is so messed up. It really is messed up, and that obviously has a chilling effect.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And it's especially difficult when, you know, even though the U.S. is so heavily involved in Syria, the U.S. spent billions of dollars there. It's one of the most expensive covert programs in the CIA's history. And now there are hundreds of U.S. troops there. Hundreds still. Basically stealing Syria's oil. That's what, as Trump said, that they're there for.
Right.
But yet we're just, you know, A, the U.S. media doesn't really talk about Syria. And B, when you try to talk about it in places like Facebook, people get suspended for sharing articles about it. So,
and you're also smeared if you talk about it.
Oh, yes. Well, of course. Yeah. That goes without saying.
That's really awful. Wow. I can't believe they just get away with that. Do they even say why? Do they have a reason?
Community guidelines.
That's so disgusting.
Yeah.
Maybe Real Clear can complain because it's
and perhaps their reasoning is that, like, you know, the title of the article is Al-Qaeda is on our side, right? That's what it's called. And
oh.
So perhaps that triggered some kind of thing where it means you're promoting Al-Qaeda. But the thing is, that title is not that those aren't my words. I'm quoting Jake Sullivan, who is the current national security advisor to Joe Biden. And in February 2012, he wrote an email to Hillary Clinton saying Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. And that's the point of the article. So perhaps that triggered the algorithm that it's promoting Al-Qaeda. But really, my article is pointing out that it was the Obama-Biden camp that was promoting Al-Qaeda.
Right. Is the Real Clear article had the same title?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because that would explain it maybe if theirs didn't. Maybe I wonder what it is. I wonder if you just have a certain, like if you're verified or something, it takes, it like the threshold is higher for them to punish you for sharing an article.
Anyway, the good news is that Elon Musk is going to make it all better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wait, that's Twitter, my bad.
Yeah, but it's the whole vibe.
Yeah, the whole vibe.
He'll be changing the vibe, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Mark Zuckerberg, for that.
Thanks, Zuck.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Well, let's start with the four basic food groups, shall we?
Let's do it.
So this is a talk about ethics. This is a Useful Idiots host on Useful Idiots host presentation. Matt Taibbi, co-founder of Useful Idiots. You know, you may know him from other things such as his award-winning books and journalism. But at TK News, he has, and of course, he's writing a book right now, which is a mixed blessing. We miss him every day, but we're also so blessed by the presence of Aaron Mate. So he has a piece up at his Substack, The Gentleman's Agreement, When TV News Won't Identify Defense Lobbyists. And he writes a piece about this, and then he also embeds a video by Matt Orfalea, which I think we could just watch that video.
So can the U.S. deliver the heavy weapons? The U.S. has contributed, I think, nearly $2 billion in aid, militarily, economic, since this war began.
And if you're just
can the U.S. be doing more?
This is
the most important thing right now is the weapon systems, the weapons they need. They need to have Stingers and the Javelins, but they also need anti-aircraft capabilities. They need anti-missile capabilities. We have to bring these weapons to get the weapons to the Ukrainians, as many weapons as necessary to provide weapons, so sophisticated weapons, whatever possible weapons can be provided.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. He works at a firm whose clients include Raytheon, the second largest military contractors in the world.
We should arm the Ukrainians.
Providing weapons, providing supplies, fences to arm with weapons, with ammunition.
We have to simply do more, to do something more.
To do more by way of supplying weapons, arms.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. He's on the board of directors at Lockheed Martin, the largest military contractor in the world.
Arm the Ukrainians, anti-tank, get them armed drones. We need to make sure that we get them air defense systems and ammunition, lots of ammunition. Whatever we can get them, we're gonna have to continue to arm the Ukrainians.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. She's the chair of the BAE Systems Board of Directors.
By the way, I've been always for us to update and modernize our nuclear arsenal. That's important.
We need to continue to flow weapons.
Flow the weapons.
They need missiles.
Anything they ask for.
We need to get the weapons.
Weapon systems.
Heavy weapons.
Weapons.
We ought to be giving them anti-ship missiles.
Missiles.
Combat jets.
Good fighter.
Ammo. Howitzers.
Plenty of firepower.
Everything.
Tanks.
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 The Javelin.
Get those weapons.
Weapon systems.
Power those weapons,
missiles,
weapons.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. He's an advisory board member of a firm with Raytheon on its client list.
So you get the point. Many, many, many conflicts of interest. No, and with people not listed, their conflicts of interest not at all listed, not even referred to.
There's so many. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. What a great video from... the two Matts, Matt Taibbi and Matt Orfalea.
Yeah.
I mean, what to say? It's so shameless, and yet it's so normalized. It's never, ever acknowledged in these media shows. It should be the most basic thing to say, but it's never, ever acknowledged.
Right.
That the people advocating policies to send more weapons to Ukraine stand to profit from them. I mean, that's just the most basic thing to acknowledge, but... Because war is so normalized and everyone supports the underlying policy, it doesn't occur to them that that's a conflict of interest, because it's just like breathing air, that it'd be natural to advocate setting off weapons to foreign countries and profiting from them. So it's not even worth acknowledging.
Right. It's just the default.
Yeah.
It's the default. And I should say that most of those people were Democrats, but or affiliated with the Democratic Party. But Kelly Ayotte is a Republican. She's a former New Hampshire senator. So this also gives I'm paying into your bucket too, because this week you have Republican suck. So that gives you a little bit of Republican suck also.
Well, it's always good to have crossover.
Yeah, cross pollination. Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of Republican suck, I have this week Greg Abbott, who is the Republican governor of Texas, and he came up with a pretty interesting scheme to try to stick it to Joe Biden when it comes to the border and the surge in refugees and migrants coming from across the southern border. And basically his plan was, well, he announced it on Sean Hannity's show on Fox. So let's watch that first, and then we'll see how it's going.
Will you send every illegal immigrant that you find in the state of Texas to Washington, D.C.?
We're going to load them up and send them to Washington, D.C. If we run out of room there, Delaware looks like a great location.
So that's Greg Abbott. He's the governor of Texas. And he's come up with this plan, basically, where he's going to pay for buses to take migrants from Texas to Washington, D.C. And this has actually begun. And the results are really interesting. Most of the migrants who have been interviewed about this are expressing gratitude because they're saying that basically this is that these buses are bringing them closer to their desired destinations, especially Miami. So we have another clip of Newsmax, which is a right-wing channel, which interviewed some migrants arriving at Washington, D.C.'s Union Station.
Said that they know that they are a prop in all of this, but they wanted to come anyway because this allows them to get a ticket to where they're going. Some of these migrants told me that they want to go on to Miami. They said they are very excited to be here. They feel welcomed. We're here in the food court at Union Station where a lot of them have been getting something to eat because this was a 34-hour bus ride, which they did tell me that they received food and drinks, but it's been a very long journey, and now they're going to be departing to other destinations. Catholic Charities has been on hand to assist them with their efforts. But I want to sit down with this group of migrants a little bit here to talk about their journey. Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Bien, bien, gracias a Dios.
¿Cómo se llama?
José Alejandro.
Alejandro. Alejandro, ¿cuántos años tienes? José. How old are you?
26.
26. Okay. 26 years old. And you're 40? ¿Sí? And
25.
25. Se siente. How do you feel?
Muy bien, gracias a Dios. Gracias a Dios que llegamos.
Destination finalmente?
Miami. Miami.
So basically, Greg Abbott is giving these people a ride to where they want to go anyway in trying to stick it to Biden, which I just thought was pretty funny.
Yeah. That's a Republicans are great. Republicans are facilitating this process. They should win an award from some, you know, organization dedicated to human rights of the undocumented.
Yeah. But look, I mean, part of the reason for this is it's approaching election time. Abbott's up for election. The midterms are coming up, and Republicans, they don't challenge Democrats on any of the areas where Democrats actually really suck. So, for example, especially in my opinion, on presiding over a proxy war, causing and presiding over a proxy war in Ukraine. But Republicans support that proxy war. So they have to find other issues that they can try to look tough on. And picking on refugees and migrants is always a tough choice for them.
Yeah, because they suck on all the things that Democrats suck on, but even more usually, although not more with Ukraine. But more
not more with
taxes.
Ukraine. It's pretty. Yes. So that's my Republicans suck.
They really do. Well, let's move on to Isn't That Weird? Aaron, you've been in like annoying phone calls or Zooms or Zoom calls or meetings, right? And you just really would love to get out of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've all been there.
Sure.
So, Wilson, can you click on the link to the soundtheexcuse.com? Stuck on a stressful video call? Then try sounding one of our excuses below and take a moment to escape. All right. Actually, you know, we should. So you can play a sound effect that makes it seem like there's an emergency that you need to tend to. So actually, Aaron, close your eyes because I want to pick some of these and I want to see if you know which one it is. So, Wilson, let's play second row all the way to the left. What do you think that is, Aaron?
I'm supposed to be able to tell what that is based on that noise.
Well, I mean, I would then follow up by saying something. This one's a weird one. I don't know if I would ever use this one. But that one is a dodgy tummy.
Dodgy tummy. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So play that again. Let's say, here, keep talking to me, Aaron. Talk to me like we're talking on a Zoom chat. Okay, go.
Okay. Hey, how's it going? Anyway, so the first quarter numbers
sorry
are
about
in.
That. I just have it. Sorry, that's my dodgy tummy. I'm going to have to call you back.
That's pretty good. Sorry. Okay, I see it. I hear a dodgy tummy.
Hear it, right? Yeah. Which other one should we do, Wilson? It's up to you.
Some of these make sense. Like, you spilled tea on your computer, or there's a food delivery, but when is there going to be a stampede coming?
Oh, yeah, let's play that one. I'd love to finish this meeting, but there's a stampede of cows coming, so we're going to...
Oh, my God. Well, I was going to share with you the quarterly feedback on the Wilson file, but I guess you can't because you have a stampede coming. Okay, well, I guess you can go.
All right, let's do one more. Close your eyes, Aaron. So how are those quarterly reports looking, Aaron?
Oh, well, sorry, someone's knocking on my door. I can't answer that really important question.
Yeah.
That's good.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like someone's stuck in the loo. Listen, they're British.
This is really smart.
This is really smart, right?
So I'm on board.
And if you scroll down all the way, Wilson, if you're wondering what this is from, if it feels a little gimmicky, it feels a little bit less like some naturally altruistic tool for helping people get out of meetings. No one should have to make an excuse to look after their mental health. If you would like help or advice on how to manage your mental health whilst working from home, visit thebookofman.com.
That was a cool idea to give people an out for their Zoom calls.
Yeah, and we'll have to link to it so that people can use it.
All right, so for Isn't That Terrible, we have a story from High Times.
Oh my gosh.
And the headline is, Bride Caterer Accused of Lacing Wedding Food with Weed. I don't know, could be great depending on how it goes. Alanis Morissette never sang about weed on a wedding day, but for one Florida bride and caterer, there was some good advice that they just didn't take. Here's the story via CNN and other media reports. 42-year-old bride Danya Shea Svoboda and 31-year-old caterer Jocelyn Bryant have been charged with culpable negligence, delivery of marijuana, and violating Florida's Anti-Tampering Act, stemming from a February wedding in Longwood, Florida, that turned into a serious buzzkill. Svoboda and Bryant had been arrested and accused of lacing wedding food, including lasagna, with marijuana and causing several guests to become sick. The affidavit says the bride agreed to and allowed Jocelyn Montrenise Bryant to lace the food she served with cannabis, unbeknownst to the attendees, many of whom became very ill and required medical attention. Deputies arrived at a community clubhouse in Longwood that night to find several guests receiving medical attention. For some, the evening was anything but enchanting. CNN reported that one woman who attended the wedding told an investigator that while she was at the hospital, she felt paranoid and believed her husband wasn't telling her the truth about other family members and that her son-in-law had died and no one was telling her. She also said she became loud and unruly in the emergency room and had to be given medication to calm down. Wow.
This is truly terrible, in my opinion.
This is truly terrible. I've had paranoid experiences off of weed before, and it was not pleasant. But at least I knew that, you know, I had consumed weed, so I was able to have some perspective on it. But in this case, these poor people didn't know; they just think they're eating wedding cake.
I mean, what if you're sober? Like, what if you've had a drug problem before?
Yeah,
they probably really were hungry. Probably got really bad munchies.
Well, and the problem with there is if you're hungry, then you go back and you eat more wedding food and you get higher.
Right.
You know, so it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. It's just very bad PR also for the cannabis movement.
Terrible. It's going to set them back.
Yeah, it really is.
It's going to set them back.
You can never violate people's consent.
No, definitely not. No. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, I mean, I'm sure maybe someone had a good time, but overall, I think that counts as terrible.
So we have a great guest. I'm so excited to be bringing him on. Michael Hudson is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, ISLET, a Wall Street financial analyst and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He is the author of several books, including Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire. He is an economic advisor to governments worldwide. We don't have time to read his entire biography because he's so prolific, but here's something I have to include, which is that in 1984, Hudson joined Harvard's archaeology faculty at the Peabody Museum as a research fellow in Babylonian economics. A decade later, he was a founding member of the International Scholars Conference on Ancient Near Eastern Economies, an international group of Assyriologists and archaeologists who analyzed the economic origins of civilization. Isn't that cool?
Really cool.
Yeah. And you can find out more about Professor Hudson and follow his work at michael-hudson.com.
All right, let's hear from Michael Hudson.
Professor Michael Hudson, thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited to have you. We wanted to start off by asking you just if you could provide an overview of what the economics driving this conflict are. And by conflict, I mean the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and, of course, the rest of the world, or really the conflict between Russia and the U.S. and the economic fallout.
Well, it depends what side you're looking at. From the Russian side, I don't think the economic factors were primary. They were threatened by NATO's expansion and really a plan to attack the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine. So I think Russia's calculations were simply military. The West's calculations were quite different. And if you look at what the results of the conflict are, you have to assume that everybody was talking about them. The results were known. They're very clear. The results are a very large increase in fuel prices, oil and energy prices, a very large increase in agricultural prices with declining supplies of food. This will leave most of Africa and Latin America, third world countries, the global south, unable to pay their foreign debts, which is going to result either in a massive debt default, or it will result in a debt repudiation. Countries are going to have to choose. Are they going to have to operate their homes without energy, their factories without energy? And energy consumption per capita is directly connected to GDP for the last 150 years. Every chart shows energy use and GDP and personal income go up together. So what are countries going to do when they can't afford to pay the higher prices for energy? Well, Janet Yellen, who was the Federal Reserve head and the Secretary of the Treasury, says, well, what we're going to do is use the International Monetary Fund to preserve America's unipolar hegemony. I think she used almost those words. We have to keep American control of the world, and we're going to do it through the IMF. And that means, in practice, using the IMF to create special drawing rights, which will be sort of like free money, the bulk of which will go to the United States to support its military spending abroad for all of this huge military escalation. And it will enable the IMF to go to countries and say, we will help you pay your debts and not be foreclosed on and get energy. But it's conditional on the usual conditions. You have to lower your wages. You have to pass anti-labor legislation. You have to agree to begin selling off your public domain and privatize. The energy and food crisis caused by the war, the NATO war against Russia, is going to be used as a lever not only to push privatization, largely under control of U.S. Investors and banks and financiers, but it's also going to lock countries into the U.S. orbit all the more, both the global south and especially Europe. One casualty is obviously going to be Europe and the euro. The euro has been plunging in value day after day after day as people realize that it's lost its export markets in Russia and much of Asia, and now at home too, because exports require energy to be made. Its cost of imports are going up, especially of energy. It's agreed to use, I think now it's $3 billion to build new port facilities to buy U.S. natural gas liquefied natural gas at three to seven times the price it's paying now, which will make it almost impossible for German firms to produce fertilizer to grow crops in Germany. The euro is plunging. The largest plunge of all has been the Japanese yen, because Japan imports all of its energy and most of its food, and that's keeping its interest rates very low in order to support the financial sector. And so the Japanese economy is being sacrificed and squeezed. And I think this is, you can't say, gee, this is an accident. This is part of the plan, because now the United States can say, you know, of course, we don't want your yen to go down so much that your consumers have to pay more. We will, of course, give you SDRs, special drawing rights, and we'll give you American aid. But we do want you to rewrite your constitution so that you can have atomic weapons on your soil, so that we can fight against China to the last Japanese, just like we're doing in Ukraine. Let us do it for you. And of course, the Japanese love that idea. The government loves that idea. They love sacrificing the population, which is what they've been doing ever since the Plaza Accord and the Louvre Accords of the 1980s that basically wrecked the Japanese industrial economy from a huge upswing to just mass shrinkage. So those are the economic effects of the war. And it's in the newspaper, you'd think the war is all about Ukrainians and NATO fighting Russians. And it's really a war by the United States to use the NATO-Russia conflict as a means of locking in control over its allies and the whole Western world, and Janet Yellen's words, reestablishing American unipolar power.
And do you think that, I mean, so assuming that this is the U.S. strategy, taking your argument at face value, do you think that this strategy will succeed?
Ultimately, it'll be self-defeating, and almost every U.S. politician and military speech has the phrase, gee, we don't want America to shoot itself in the foot. Obviously, they're all worried about it. It's a huge gamble. Apparently, the military was not even consulted in the sanctions that were put against Russian Russian energy. And the military wasn't consulted even on much of the plans by the State Department and the National Security, the neocons that are running the NATO war. And so obviously there's a lot of doubts within the military, but they don't speak up. That's not what they do. It's amazing that in Europe, the only opposition to this is coming from the right wing, people like Marine Le Pen, not from the left wing. So the left wing in Europe, the social, I should say what is now the right wing, the social democratic parties, the Labour Party, those are the parties that are thoroughly behind NATO. And there doesn't seem to be a political alternative in these countries except going along with the policy that's going to squeeze their balance of payments and lock them into dependency in the United States. So what seems to be happening, if there's no fight back on the part of Europe, obviously, if you look at the United Nations vote on whether to come out with a policy against Russia, many countries either abstained or voted against it. So the big economic result is structural. It means there's like an iron curtain between the white Western world, Europe and North America and the Five Eyes, and Eurasia, China, India, and Russia, and their surrounding territories. And if you have China, India, and Russia, or what Mackinder called Eurasia, the world core, then are you going to have the rest of Asia coming along? The question is going to be what happens with Taiwan, Japan, and North Korea. They're pretty much up for grabs. And 2 days ago, the NATO leader, Stoltenberg, said that NATO has to have a presence in the South China Sea. that NATO has to defend Europe in the Pacific, in China. So you can see the conflict that's coming there. And I think you also had one of the NATO people, a European politicians, the head negotiator, saying this war, this cannot be settled economically. It cannot be settled by treaty. It can only be settled militarily. Well, so then you're back to how does the military going to affect the economy? Well, Russia can not afford to lose because if it loses, they're going to be NATO is going to put atomic weapons right in Ukraine, right next to its border, as it wants to do in Latvia and Estonia. And the U.S. apparently is taking a position. We can't lose because if we lose, Biden won't be reelected. Biden needs apparently is now running the military and economic campaign with a view towards how can he be reelected in November with the only real variable in the American strategy being the American public itself. Which, unfortunately, there's almost no discussion of what we're talking about today, except, you know, your show, the internet, Saker, the others. So everything is up for grabs.
And by the way, I mean, if this is Biden's thinking, he's doing so even though most Americans don't wake up caring about Ukraine. It's not their top concern, but that's a very different, there's a very different attitude inside the White House. Obviously, they do. Let me ask you about Russia. Can Russia afford to weather all of this? As we're speaking, Russia has recently cut off gas deliveries to Poland and Bulgaria. Let's say your other parts of Europe follow suit and refuse to pay in rubles for gas payments as Putin has demanded. Can Russia afford to cut off more countries or from receiving Russian energy, or is Putin bluffing there? Do you think?
No, of course it can afford to cut it off because Russia is pretty much self-contained. If you look at how it survived the 1990s and the shock therapy, any country that could survive the shock therapy, nothing is going to be that serious again. So it's already, it's shown that it can survive 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and it can survive much better than Europe can survive.
Michael. Let me push back there. It survived, but the 90s took a very heavy toll on Russia.
Yes, it did. Absolutely.
So are you suggesting that Russia might face that again?
No, I don't think it'll be that serious again, because now it has the support of China and other India, other countries. Before, it was completely dismantled from within. Now, it's not dismantled from within. It's rebuilt, certainly its military. It's rebuilt enough of its economy and made enough links with other economies who are politically supporting it. Because Biden has said again and again, we've got to destroy Russia because if we destroy Russia, we will cut it off from China and then we can go against China as our real enemy. So we've got to cut up the world that is potentially opposing us. First Russia, then China, maybe India too. And he's been very explicit in this, so you can imagine where this leaves China and India. India's already said, well, look, we're economically linked to Russia. We're going to continue to link. Russia's foreign reserves were stolen in the West. And it's going to basically work with China to create some kind of just mutual currency swaps, like United States arranges with Europe and other countries currency swaps so that they can hold each other's currency. And China knows that ultimately it'll be repaid through a new pipeline to deliver gas to China. So what I think a decision has been made in Russia that it's decoupling with the West, certainly decoupling from Europe, decoupling from the United States, except for marginal trade, and reorienting itself towards the West because it can't afford deal with the West on these terms anymore. So yes, it's going to be painful, but I think the Russian people who get a very different report of the war and the violence and terrorism that's going on than the American press has, the Russians seem to be 80% behind Putin, And it's not like it was in the 90s when they were utterly demoralized.
And so how does this end?
It's not going, the military fighting is not going to end this year or next year. It's going to take at least 30 years to end. And it will end probably with a split between the West, Europe in the West on the one hand, and Eurasia on the other hand, with more and more of Africa and South America linking itself to the Eurasian economy as Europe and the American economies shrink. Almost everyone sees shrink. I think President Xi of China said the other day, he sees that the American economy is shrinking, and certainly the European economy is shrinking for a decade, if or as long as it continues the neoliberal course. And I think that's pretty obvious it's going to shrink. And Xi also said that's because a centrally planned economy, which they call socialism or Marxism with Chinese characteristics, is more efficient than democracy, because democracy really turns into oligarchy very quickly. And the oligarchy turns into a hereditary aristocracy. And the West is not a democracy anymore. The West is an oligarchy turning into a hereditary aristocracy. And Chinese are trying to prevent the financial class from becoming an independent class, pursuing policies that impoverish labor, because they, for them, banking and credit is still a public utility. That was the most important sector to be socialized in China. And that's what makes China so different from the United States, that you could say that bankers are, and Wall Street are, the central planners of the West, and their central planning is in favor of the finance, insurance, and real estate sector. And bankers are in charge of China through the treasury, which is run by party officials that are not seeking to make capital gains for wealthy families, but are using finance to build up their industry and infrastructure and make themselves independent of the West, so that America can never do to China what it did to Russia.
And if you were to predict the first places where we're going to see a major fallout, major unrest as a result of higher commodity prices due to this war in Ukraine, where will it be?
I would say Latin America and Africa, third world countries that are not have followed World Bank policy for the last 70 years and not produced their own food, but have produced export crops. So they're dependent on importing food, primarily American grain exports, and importing American energy. And probably the central economic aim of the NATO war against Russia was to reconcentrate control of the world energy trade in the hands of American, English, and Dutch oil companies. So basically, the oil companies the U.S. Are going to let the third world countries go into a crisis. If they default on their bonds, then the United States gets to, and the bondholders get to treat Latin America like they treated Argentina, and try to or Venezuela, and grab whatever assets they have outside of their country, like Venezuela had investments in the United States and gold that it left in the Bank of England that were grabbed. There's going to be just a huge asset grab that is supposed to be how this unfolds. And the most obvious assets to be grabbed are going to be in Latin America and Africa, maybe some Asian deficit countries. So this is the weakest link. And that's why there's this fight within the IMF at the upcoming meetings to create these special drawing rights to give the money on the condition that there's a class war. So what we're saying really isn't a war between NATO and Russia. It's a class war of the neoliberals against labor across the world to establish the power of finance over labor.
And so do you think that there's a threat of an even worse hunger crisis in this world, one that we're not talking about and should be preparing for?
A threat. That's the objective. Yes, of course. That's what they're aiming at. If you read what Klaus Schwab says at the World Economic Forum, he said there are 20% too many people in the world, especially in the global south. This is what all the big foundations are for, the billionaires. They all say, we've got to thin out the population. There are too many consumers that don't produce enough wealth for us. If they produce wealth for themselves, that doesn't count, because that's not for us, and we don't get it. So, that's not going to be an accident. That is obviously anyone who looks at the basic economic trends can see that this is inevitable, and you have to assume that this was discussed as part of the whole big neoliberal plan of the Biden administration and the deep state behind it.
How different is this from what we saw with Trump? How continuous or how much of an aberration do we have between the different administrations?
It's pretty much the same. The same groups are still in control. Trump was going to appoint that general who was going to basically clean out the State Department and the CIA, but his son-in-law convinced him not to appoint this person. Trump didn't have anyone in his administration able to close down this whole neocon group there. So basically, he let them destroy. Essentially, they just ignored what he did. He wanted to withdraw troops from Syria, and the army just refused to withdraw the troops. Nobody followed his orders. So he was an aberration politically, but the presidency of the U.S. these days is pretty much a figurehead for the deep state behind them. So I don't think there's that much difference. The Republicans are as much behind this plan as the Democrats.
Let me ask you about the economic toll on Ukraine from this conflict, and not just from Russia's invasion, but the last 8 years since the US-backed coup. And maybe we can start with what happened in the fall of 2013, because the conventional story that we get told a lot in the US is that basically this whole crisis began when Ukraine when Ukraine was in talks with the EU under Yanukovych, the ousted president. And Yanukovych was going to sign this agreement with the EU, and that's what most Ukrainians wanted. It would have brought liberty to Ukraine. And then Russia basically sabotaged it and told him and ordered him not to. And that's when Ukrainians came out to protest.
You're not saying this, Aaron, right? You're saying this is the mainstream narrative that we've been fed.
Yes, this is the mainstream narrative that we've been fed. And so that's when Ukrainians came out to protest with the Maidan Revolution, as it's called. And that's what led to the coup in February 2014 that ousted Yanukovych. Can you talk about, you know, what that narrative gets wrong, especially the actual terms of the agreements that Yanukovych was being asked to sign by the EU and what that would have meant for Ukraine?
Well, Russia couldn't really tell Yanukovych what to do, because Yanukovych was always independent. Russia offered a better deal, and Yanukovych said the deal that the EU was offering would make it much poorer than the continuation of the relationships that it had with Russia, which, after all, were its traditional relationships. So Yanukovych didn't sign the EU deal. And at that point, it wasn't the Ukrainians that protested. It was a neo-Nazi group that was positioned that set itself up with snipers all around Maidan Square. And it was the Nazi group that began firing on the policemen to make it appear as if it were the government, and to fire on the general crowd. So basically, the coup was sponsored by the United States, who put in the officials that were designated by Miss Nuland. And the Ukrainians had hoped that somehow joining the EU would make them prosperous. Well, that's the myth that Europe had, that if it would only take U.S. advice, it would end up as prosperous with as many consumer goods as the United States. And it was all a myth. But when Yanukovych and his board that looked at it, they said, well, we're not going to make money this way, basically. And the kleptocrats who were running Ukraine at that time, the Ukrainians weren't running Ukraine. It was considered by the World Bank and every agency to be the most corrupt country in Europe. And the kleptocrats thought, wait a minute, if we sign that, then the Europeans are going to take over our property. And they're going to want to buy us out. And we're going to end up with some yachts and some real estate in England, like the Russian kleptocrats. But we're not, it's really going to be a giveaway. So they were certainly behind Yanukovych and saying, this is not a good deal with this. That's when the U.S. decided that it needed the coup. And even at that time, it realized that it had the idea of long-term fighting against Russia as the first domino to fall to fight against China. That was in the discussion already at that time in 2014.
Right. Carl Gershman is the former head of the National Endowment for Democracy. He called Ukraine, quote, the biggest prize in what he saw as a struggle against Russia. And he thought that actually bringing Ukraine into the Western orbit would actually lead to regime change even in Russia and lead to Vladimir Putin's downfall.
Well, he was a Trotskyist and a neocon and a virulent Russia hater.
An example of that great Trotskyist to neocon trajectory that we see.
Yeah.
So much.
One small point, though. I think the protests that happened initially against Yanukovych, I think that was actually a large mass of people. That wasn't neo-Nazi. I think the neo-Nazi.
Right. But they didn't do the coup. They were behind the coup.
Yeah. Were definitely the far right, as they've even taken credit for openly. You mentioned the kleptocrats in Russia. Let me ask you about that. What is the real state of the oligarchy in Russia? We hear in the U.S. constantly about the Russian oligarchs and, you know, they're sort of blamed for all the world's ills. What is the actual reality of Russian oligarchs? How has that evolved under Putin? This oligarch class was obviously created under Yeltsin with the advice of U.S. Technocrats who came in. What is the actual power of the oligarchs in Russia now and their relationship with Vladimir Putin?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. Well, that was great, huh?
Really interesting. Michael Hudson has a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience to share, and it was great to talk to him.
Yeah, he was really, I could listen to him all day, but we had to be respectful of his time, but I could have listened and listened. So many great stories from the personal to the political. And guys, if you are not already Substack subscribers, you're going to want to be, because we got some great behind the scenes kind of tea spillage. I think it counts as spilling the tea, right? Hearing about his working with neocons and why he thinks they're a bunch of sociopaths and psychopaths. Some interesting personal stories, some really great insights into the mind of the neocon. So you're definitely going to want to become Substack subscribers at usefulidiots.substack.com. And Aaron, I loved a part when you were recounting the official narrative of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And I think he forgot that you were recounting a narrative, not endorsing the narrative. And his eyes were like...
That's, yeah. Yeah, well, when you know the truth, it's hard to hear propaganda, especially if it's coming from someone on the left. So if you thought that's what I was doing, then that's
right.
Fine.
That's why I had to jump in and remind him, because I was afraid he was going to have an aneurysm.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Michael Hudson. It was really great to hear from him.
Yeah.
And
make sure you go to michael-hudson.com.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
See you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
We'll be right back. Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.